Welcome to CMDA's Voice of Advocacy podcast. Here's your host, Dr. Brick Lance.
Welcome to the Voice of Advocacy podcast. I'm your host again, Dr. Brick Lance, and again, my very special guest who I've had before, my partner in crime, JC Bicek. Welcome, JC.
Good morning, Dr. Lance. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And we're going to discuss everything bioethics, not everything, but actually some very interesting issues. Because you know, in the world of bioethics, JC, there's something new, if not every day, at least every week, that pops up that kind of maybe even shocks you at times.
No, absolutely. There's nothing dull about this. And I think a lot of people might think bioethics and their eyes roll back, but we have a lot of fun thinking about these things. There's always something new.
It is. It's fun. It's enjoyable. So we have four topics to discuss today. We are going to discuss children growing up in a household where there's good relationships. I'll leave it at that. So a sociological study. It is a longitudinal sociological study. We are going to come back to IVF, but I've got some nuances to bring to the table on IVF. We talk about IVF a lot, but I'm going to put a couple twists in there, and we're going to talk about the ethics involved. We're also going to talk about brain organoids, the ethics of doing research with brain organoids. And then lastly, we're going to discuss obesity. And I know we've actually discussed it before, but we do have some new studies, if you will, coming out, particularly with the use of what we call GLP-1s, like Ozempic, and there's some difference of opinions on that. So we're going to address that issue as well. So let's get started. There was an article in JAMA Pediatrics from January of this year, 2026. It's a longitudinal study, took place more than two decades, longitudinal studies of children growing up in a household where there's family connection, and most importantly, with a biological mother and father. Kind of very interesting study. Over 7,000 individuals were studied, and they studied different time frames along the decades. And they were looking at external results, not necessarily internal, not the kids' well-being now that they're adults, but the external factors. And that includes mental health, such as depression. It includes work satisfaction, occupation. It includes extended education, socioeconomic status, crime involvement, and those types of things. And I found it just interesting from the standpoint that children that do grow up in a good relationship home benefit far better than children that do not. In fact, twice as likely to have these benefits as opposed to families with a broken home. I'll leave it at that. What'd you take away from this study?
Yeah, I can't believe that anybody would have thought otherwise. It seems so straightforward, and that we needed research on it is unfortunate, but I think it underscores, you know, where we are as a culture, that we need to sort of reveal these truths once again and highlight them. But the data is staggering. I mean, yeah, twice as likely just to have meaningful social connection. These aren't unimportant things. It's not like, oh, he's got a twice as high rate of going to an Ivy League school. That's not really important, but just pure social connection. These are things that are determined largely by just having a strong traditional family to support a child.
And, of course, we know the basic truth, you know, put your cell phones away at dinner, have discussions at dinner, just the basic things. And I'm sure you do that with your three little kids at home that I've been over at your home and having dinner, and yeah, we don't have any distractions.
We don't allow our four-year-old to have a phone, but okay. I know some people do.
Now, some of this research is not new. Of course, Brad Wilcox's book, which I think is a very good book, I'd recommend Get Married, that was published in 2024. Mm-hmm. And there's others that have published on this type of research. There's Isabel Sahil, David Rebar, Ron Haskins, Melissa Kearney. They've all got great publications on the findings of this. And it's funny, when I work with students and I give them this research, particularly what I would call medical students or nursing students, they kind of say that's not true, even though the sociological studies prove it. In other words, you can grow up in a single-family household or a gay couple's household or with non-biological parents, but the sociological studies do prove true.
Yeah, I think that they don't want it to be true. I think they'd like for the alternative lifestyle to yield the same results, but why should it? Why should they have the same outcomes? And I think we're fooling ourselves and wishing that certain things would be the case, and we don't want to do hard things. And I think we're going to talk about some of that a little bit later, some of these other issues. But that's we'd like for things to just go how we want them. But when we're driving up against what's natural and the created order, we're going to have problems. But we acknowledge that it's not to say that this is a foolproof. You know, you have a married husband and wife, and they pour into their child, and then therefore their child is going to turn out to be just spectacular. We know that's not true. But again, these studies show that, you know, if you want to increase the odds, if you want a greater likelihood, but I think we can get at why that is the case, and why those other things would fail. Just that the Christian worldview is so revelational in this.
Yeah, so no guarantees, but statistically significant, and we ought to follow or heed the findings in this article. There was an interesting quote, actually, in the article, almost a double negative.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, so the study concludes, and it sort of gets back at what we were saying. They don't want it to be true. There's some that we can't really get at the truth for whatever reason, or we're ashamed of it. Really, I think what it is this moral relativism. We can't really say what is moral and what is good. So yeah, the conclusion is, they say, however, efforts to increase the exposure of adolescents to safe, stable, and nurturing relationships at home are unlikely to cause harm. why do you need to say that? And it may contribute to their capacity as adults to create and maintain social connection, thereby addressing the increasing prevalence of loneliness and social isolation. Like, there's just this sort of like, well, we obviously, these results show us, but we can't make any sort of moral determinations about it. And why would we? We're not those types of people. But it was an interesting study to conduct. I mean, come on, what was the point? And
you wonder
what
if they really had an agenda.
Well,
you know, but fortunately, science proves people with agenda wrong and does actually follow God's design if it's true, good research.
But I guess that's what we need this research for. Like I said, it seems like a silly thing to report on. But because people have agendas and ideologies, and those start to gain steam, then we need to get back to the basics and say, wait a second. Hey, I think that the way that God designed it is the way that's the most beneficial to our society, and certainly simply to young children as they develop.
Hey, let's switch to IVF, in vitro fertilization, under the umbrella of assisted reproductive technology. I've got three articles to discuss with you, JC. And then after those three articles, I want to discuss public policy, because I know you recently followed a state bill. And then we also partner with an organization trying to protect children. But here's an interesting story. Fox News from January 30th, 2026. It's about a couple, and it happens to be a Caucasian couple, and that went through in vitro fertilization of their own frozen embryo from 5 years previously. But lo and behold, they had a child that was genetically unrelated. It was pretty obvious because it was a completely different skin color and didn't have it genetically tested. So the couple then questioned, well, who's got our baby? Obviously, there was a mix-up of these frozen embryos, and this was interesting in the article. They requested through their attorney that every child born through this fertilization clinic, every child be genetically tested so they can find theirs. Now, that's got some issues too. And I don't know how, they don't give the number of children. But, you know, that's an interesting finding. I think we're going to find more mix-ups in the future as well. Okay, the next study, we can come back to that. Next study in NPR, and they call it NPR WETS. This is from January 18th, 2026. So families in Israel that have lost their son in the war, and so this is particularly the Gaza war, and there were hundreds of soldiers that lost their life, actually, which was, I did not know the numbers, but 25% of them had their sperm harvested after they were deceased. And I guess technically you have to harvest the sperm within 72 hours. They were trying to do it within 24 hours and then freeze the sperm, you know, and go to the mothers, particularly the mothers, but mothers and fathers, trying to get them to save the sperm so that they could have a grandchild in the future. But this brings up all kinds of ethical issues. You know, many of these male soldiers are left with widows. And so are we going to use, you know, it would be their own husband's sperm, but they could also use the sperm for in vitro fertilization of others as well, or even surrogacy or whatever. But I think the majority were widows. But Israel has no laws and regulations over this. So I find it interesting. And the third article is also from NPR from January 29th of 2026. And this is in the country of India, where women are selling their eggs, so for in vitro fertilization for others. And I will just put out there, it sounds like it's exploitation and human trafficking, because these women, you know, undergo this procedure. They get 20 to 30 eggs harvested, and they only give them about $200 to $300. And of course, since it's, quote, illegal, some even don't get paid after the procedure at all. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about the poor women in India who are trying to put food on the table. And there's over 7,000 fertility clinics in the country of India. But anyway, I find this fascinating. Of course, harvesting eggs, as we know, is a whole lot harder or more difficult than harvesting sperm, of course. But that brings up all kinds of legal, ethical, cultural issues. So taking these three topics together, the wrong baby from IVF, harvesting gametes from dead people, and then the commercialization, particularly of women in India. Are we in a wild, wild west with IVF?
To say the least, I think we acknowledge that people want to bring life into this world and it's good. And we have certain medical issues that prevent childbearing, rearing, giving birth. And so therefore, you know, we just naturally look for technology to solve those problems. But goodness, it is very capable, apparently, of opening up, you know, Pandora's box, right? There's a lot here that can happen. I don't want to say that it can go wrong, but there are a lot of things. Actually, there's just a quote from the article about Israel. They said, "We started doing it before we had time to think what is right to do." That's very
telling.
That's
a problem with any technology.
Unfortunately, it doesn't have to be, but it is. It seems to be.
But again, I brought up three different countries. So we have our own country, our own problems with any kind of regulation of IVF, and people are getting the wrong babies. And of course, as we have spoken before, I think there's a problem with freezing embryos. We don't necessarily have to go down that road. And then we have harvesting gametes, which is not as ethically problematic as dealing improperly with embryos, because it is just a gamete. But they do pull on the heartstrings, both of the widows and the then-to-be grandparents, if you will. Mm-hmm. So I understand that. And then we have commercialization of human eggs. It's certainly some exploitation going on there and not even following the legal regulations of the country. So that begs the question, we should have better regulation in the United States, do you not think?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. There's, again, this is just, I think you said, the tip of the iceberg and so far as the issues that can result from this creating life in the lab, moving things away from what is defined as natural. But I say that because the idea that, you know, the further we move away from what's natural, the greater the moral hazard, the greater the risk. So again, and we say like, oh, and some people are just so, I don't want to say simple-minded in this, but just it's like, oh, it brings life into the world. That's good. People can't have a baby. They want to have a baby. This is good. And so we just think in those terms, and what do we need to regulate? Like we're bringing babies into the world. Everybody loves babies. And so it's just this, it's a very simple perspective, but yet we see when you look behind the curtain, there's a whole lot more going on. There's a whole lot more that can happen, and not just that can. We're showing these things. There's some just heinous things in here. There's some just mind-boggling, some of the things that are said, some of the things that, and so, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll even say, you know, with Israel, you say, no, that there was some sort of restriction, but then they've done away with it to make this easier.
Right.
Because given the circumstance, oh, wait, you want, and they're not even thinking about it. It's just like, this is a circumstance we hadn't thought, oh, you need to get rid of any sort of boundary, any sort of barrier. And yeah, we're just, I mean, people need to read these articles and just think, how could this happen? How did this happen? And then they start to realize, oh, maybe we do need some restriction. But you're absolutely right. And I mean, I think we'll get to that. But we're creating a significant moral hazard. It doesn't mean that absolutely things have to go wrong, but we are increasing the risk. And I don't know that that's the way that we want to live. I think that we think that the ends justify the means, but we're looking at some of the things that are going on in the pursuit of people having, there's a lot to say about this that we don't really have time to get into today, but I'd encourage, and one of the things that we will we can talk about relating to the sociology study and the relationships with families. That ties back to this. This is what, you know, Katie Faust's organization, Them Before Us. That's what all these kind of point towards people thinking about themselves, parents, would-be parents thinking about themselves. And it seems there's very little thought about the future, the well-being of the child. And it's something that we need. Is this what's best for the child? When you read through these articles, is this what's best for, who is this best for? What is the motivation? And is it indicative of our hearts? What does it say about our hearts? Is it, oh, they're just so big and we want more kids? Or is it revealing of something more?
Yeah. And as you know, Them Before Us, if our listeners don't remember, that mm-hmm. them is children mm-hmm. and us is adults. And we make a lot of medical and a lot of ethical decisions on the autonomous decision of adults. And we need to reverse that trend.
Yeah.
And that's what Them Before Us. In fact, our friend Katie Faust, who you mentioned, she calls it big fertility here in the United States because there is a lot of money that trades hands with this fertility industry, which also brings, I think, bad incentives into this. Now, JC, you are at CMDA, our state director of public policy. In fact, I think a fertility bill just came up in a state recently in South Dakota, if I'm correct, and we had one last year that passed in Tennessee. And as we know, then our federal government, at least our current administration, is trying to promote IVF without any mm-hmm, regulations mm-hmm. or boundaries. Now, tell me, the South Dakota bill had some boundaries, correct?
Yeah, so this is a mixed bag. There's been a lot of these bills that have come up in this so far in this session, a lot of bills related to fertility, to IVF, and I think we can understand why, especially that was it a year and a half, 2 years ago, the Alabama Supreme Court making a ruling, and now everybody's acting on oh, we need to start restricting, or we need to start, you know, becoming more, I suppose, liberal with our policies here. But yeah, we're seeing that there's, I mean, you look at these things, these stories, and there's more. I've got another one here on fertility fraud, and that the some of these are signing up, and they are being told that this is an anonymous donor, and it's actually the doctor's gametes.
Oh,
well, that's
goodness.
That's just nuts. So yeah, this in particular, the bill that we have here that we were looking at is very simple. In South Dakota, House Bill 1164, it was heard this last week, and fortunately, it passed out of the committee and out of the House unanimously, and now it's moved on to the Senate. But it's very simple. It's not we don't have to take great strides to start to restrict these bills. But what this bill sponsor understood is we need to start at least drawing attention to some of the moral hazards, to some of the risks that are involved here, and some of the things that can go wrong. And CMDA has a position statement on IVF, and we don't say as an organization that you can never do IVF. IVF is evil. Well, no, that's not what the position says. It acknowledges the moral hazard again. But what this bill starts to do is starts to put up some guardrails, starts to show like maybe we should prosecute somebody for fertility fraud. But you know, what we would say is, you know, that fertility fraud couldn't really happen if we weren't so anxious to move life, the creation of life, you know, outside of its natural creation to that in the lab. And there's more of these bills, and we're encouraged by it. And you know, certainly I'll just plug that if any listeners hear about any of these bills or interested in any of these bills, you know, certainly contact us. You know, we'll plug that our email address is advocacy@cmda.org. But these are things that we want to start because there's children, but just the idea of life on the line here. There's so much to say about IVF, and again, it's just not. People think babies are good. Well, there's more to it than
that. There's more to it than that. In fact, going back to India, they call it the one-stop shop because you have male gametes, you have female gametes, you have sperm, you have egg, you have embryos, you have surrogacies, women willing to be paid to be surrogates. You have all this in one shop. And now we have these boutique clinics in the United States, and they come up with very creative names. One is Exceptional, you know, just an acronym. Another one, The Chosen One.
Oh, my.
You know, so, and there's all
That's
kinds
terrible.
Of names. It is terrible. Again, I think it's an exploitation. It is big fertility, and there needs to be regulation. So we are partnering with Them Before Us, that organization. They have legislative plans, include what it's called is Child First Conception Act. And they'd like to get this in more and more states of putting some regulations on this fertility business, and mm-hmm, we are partnering mm-hmm. with them in that, and yeah. Hopefully we'll be successful.
Yeah, absolutely. This is, we know with legislation, very few things if any, ever move quickly. So this isn't something that we're going to knock out of the park here this session, but this is something to certainly for our listeners, for all CMDA members to be paying attention to, is sort of this is the next frontier in the pro-life movement and thinking about what it means to treat image bearers with dignity, and certainly thinking about what we want our society to look like. And, are we interested in this libertine nature towards these things? And because, again, when you peek behind the curtain, there's a lot going on that is not good. And so, yeah, we're excited to partner with them. And, they've really taken a lead on this. And this is a movement that we're hoping can really have really change the tide on some of these things.
Yeah, and so this is a combination effort of attorneys who know the legal language, mm-hmm. bioethicists know the ethical language, and physicians know the medical language, coming together to hopefully form some policies that states can follow. So more news on that in the future. And if you hear something coming up in your state, listeners, please let us know. Hey, we're going to switch now. We're going to go to human neural organoids. So this article talks about taking human brain tissue, and by the way, the article has some wonderful pictures of these brain mm-hmm. organoids, and taking glial cells and other cells, and then growing them into this assembloid, if they call it, and then injecting it into animals, and particularly into animals' brains. Now, I will say that they are trying to help some diseases that we all want to help.
Oh, absolutely.
And that includes autism, schizophrenia, brain cancer, and others. What's your thoughts on this type of research?
So the first thing you talk about is injecting into animals, and it brings up, and there's should we be concerned with this? Should we? The great question, but let's take a step back. They're not asking the same, these researchers aren't asking the same things about, is there something morally problematic with doing research on embryos? No, of course that's totally fine, but at the animals, that's our primary concern. And so I'm kind of cynical when I read such a thing that, you know, our first concern is the animals. We're not really concerned with the people. I think that's telling of a worldview. But yeah, we said this earlier, we have to ask the question, do the ends always justify the means? And there's some interesting research here, absolutely. There's some great things that they are doing, but it seems highly unregulated. And it seems like something that we could potentially set ourselves up for problems down the road. Now, I don't know, maybe you're not as optimistic about the outcomes of this. And then that's, you know, well, you can pursue this, but nothing's going to happen, you know, super morally problematic. But
yeah, our last discussion we had about bioethics, we talked about the in vitro gametogenesis, mm-hmm. where you can take other pluripotential cells, if you will, and form gametes and then fertilize with that, which, again, I'm not sure that's going to go anywhere scientifically, but we'll find out. Again, this research happens. Now, I will give some benefit that, so the scientists here, they gathered a group of individuals, had a two-day conference in California discussing the science, but they also did discuss the ethics behind it. Mm-hmm. So at least they're considering the ethics behind it. And they do ask the question is, will we get to the point where building organoids that can actually recapitulate something that we associate with human capacities. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they're thinking way down the road, will this actually have, again, human capacities or a human soul? Again, I'm normally a very optimistic person about medicine and research, mm-hmm. but this sounds crazy to me.
Well, we could get into the metaphysics of that as well. And there's things to critique, other sort of comments that they make in that way about the capacities. Well, I think capacities aren't what make us human or a person. I think that's really important, especially when we talk about embryos. Well, they don't have the same capacities or the same abilities that you and I have right now. And that's as we age, we lose those. And so therefore, what does it really mean? And so there's some of this they think there. But the other thing is they're talking about creating humans. I mean, as far as being cynical about or just a little bit more pessimistic, the reality is we still don't know where consciousness comes from. And to think that it's only in the brain, I'd like to talk to some of the neurologists that think that they have found that. Neurosurgeons, I don't know that they can pinpoint that. So there's a bit of this like, oh, we think that we're going to create something that you still don't really have a clue what you're doing.
And I'm not a good enough neural scientist to understand that if it actually has any potential to cure any of these diseases or even help these diseases, mm-hmm. I would think cancer would be one because cancer treatment particularly in my career, my lifetime, has changed dramatically with targeting the cancer cells, and you wonder if that could happen. I don't know, but interesting research going on that area.
We'll keep an eye on that.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk, which we have discussed before, JC, about obesity, but these are two articles. One is from The Times, January 16th, 2026, and one's from The New Atlantis, which was also, this just came out, spring of 2026. Kind of different perspectives. The Times title is Welcome to Ozempic, if I said that right, Ozempic Town, USA, citing a town in Kentucky. And the other, The New Atlantis, is a analysis of MAHA, Make America Healthy Again, and the Department of HHS, the Health and Human Services, and are they having the right approach to obesity? Now, these oral, again, we call GLP-1s, they decrease hunger. They have not been around very long, just a couple of years. So there's been substantial benefit. In fact, the first time in recent history in the United States, the rate of obesity has decreased each of the last 3 years, which is all attributed to these drugs. So is that a good thing?
That's a loaded question. to see that decline, that is a good thing. To think about people's health risks being reduced, that is a good thing.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because one of the article sites, which I think is true globally, the number one health risks around the world have been malnutrition or infectious disease. And one in two, depending on when you study it. Now they're saying that obesity, at least certain areas of the world, is probably the number one cause of medical issues.
Well, yeah. I mean, here this article talks about in the U.S. that so where in the world are we having this problem? Here, clearly, in this country, I think we have the greatest problem with it. But there's something that the costs associated each year are approaching $1.4 trillion. That's staggering. Yeah, there's something to say. I wanted to note that both the New Atlantis a couple months ago and also World have interesting articles about how we went from that world of malnutrition, of not enough food, to now we have the surplus. But that didn't solve our problem. It created new problems. And yeah, we're seeing that. And I think a stat that you pointed out earlier, but that was that the obesity rate during JFK's presidency was
3%.
3%. Right?
And now it's close. It's 40%.
It's 40%. But at the same time,
also in Japan. Well, Japan, their current rate is 3%.
Yeah. So it's really hard to say that this is simply a genetic thing. This is just all these environmental factors, so on and so forth. We have to ask, I mean, again, we're seeing this data in America. So what's going on in our country? What's different in our country versus Japan versus, you know, a number of other countries that are not suffering with these same issues?
Yeah, let me go medically. And again, there may be some benefit short term for these drugs. I will tell you, in my practice, I saw a significant amount of obesity for patients that need surgery. And if they're going to get a joint replacement, there is a requirement because associated risk, which is known scientifically what the risks are and how that increases with obesity. But for me to do a joint replacement, they had to be below a 40 body mass index. And if you're over 40, you're called morbidly obese. And the hospital would not let us do their surgery either, but it's part of my practice. But some of the happiest patients that I had in my practice were those that had the incentive to lose the weight. And once the incentive was there, they did lose the weight and they were able to get the surgery. Now, the incentive may still be there, but it might be easier, I don't know, just to take this oral drug and lose the weight. The problem is there's this rebound phenomena. Mm-hmm. The weight may come back in when they stop the drug. Now, again, if patients had the difficulty, there are specialists in your community that just do bariatric medicine, caring for those with obesity. And it's multifaceted, but that includes surgery, includes the stomach stapling, which probably has a longer-term effect, not always successful, but longer-term effect, offers you higher risk, too, than taking these oral drugs. Now, the New Atlantis talks about Make America Healthy Again, of changing what's in the food, how it's processed, and those types of issues that come to our table. So I think there's some, I don't agree with everything that HHS has proposed the last couple of years, but this is one I probably actually do agree with them on this. Your thoughts on that as well?
Well, one, again, we're pointing out an American problem. And as far as I'm aware from my rather crunchy wife, the food is different in Europe than it is in the U.S. It's different in a lot of countries. A lot of them, you know, ban certain things in their food, and we're taking steps to do that. That's what this, administration is interested in. You know, whether it's food dyes or other sort of chemicals that are added to our food, at least drawing attention to them. Whether they've made any sort of strides to ban, we've got a whole lot more attention now on what's going into our food in a way that I don't think we were really paying attention, at least broadly, before recently.
And I'm excited to see in the future, and won't probably be the near future, but over years, if it does make a significant difference, one, of course, for the rate of obesity, but the associated illnesses and cancer for one, particularly colorectal cancer. And then also these additives are possibly causes for autoimmune disease, which has also increased significantly in our country. So who knows the outcome? But I think they do have legitimate authority to change the eating habits at a federal level. That includes school lunches. It includes the SNAP program. And of course, obviously some of the manufacturers objecting when they are taking away the sugary drinks and processed food in those programs. But I think it's a good thing myself.
You know, it would be a libertarian take here, but you know, if somebody wants to buy their super sugary this, that, and buy this, you know, ultra processed something, go ahead and do it. But you know, to make the taxpayer pay for it, especially when we're seeing the cost associated with these diseases, why would we continue to incentivize that as a government? Now, yeah, you get into the companies that are resisting this. Well, yeah, because it's going to hurt their bottom line. But what are we really concerned with as a culture? Are we concerned with this laissez-faire? Do whatever you want to do. If that's a tack you want to take, if you want to do what you want to do, you can pay for it yourself.
Now, I don't know if I have an opinion on this, and I'm going to kind of close with this, JC, but is these drugs, the GLP-1s, because Ozempic is the one that most know, but you know, the Super Bowl just happened this last weekend, and they had these commercials, which were $10 million for 30 seconds to advertise these drugs. Apparently, there's 39 GLP-1s that are in development now. So,
well, isn't Novo Nordisk the most valuable company in the world as a result of their
developing
these drugs?
Yep.
Wow.
So that's interesting. Now, the other finding interesting is 13%, which is a very high number, 13% of Americans have taken a GLP-1. Mm-hmm. So I find that fascinating. Now, the question is, will insurance companies cover it? Because it's not cheap. I mean, some of them are like $500 a month, some of the more expensive ones. So because the injectable drugs. So there's all kinds of ramifications, social issues, legal issues, informed consent, the long-term effects, you know, insurance coverage. Right. Obviously, they've become extremely popular, and we'll see if this trend continues. Yeah. But I do want to see the long-term results, which we don't have yet.
Yeah, we can't go without saying that there are moral implications. There are implications for ethics and virtue and just what it says about our culture and what we value, what's good, what we understand to be good. There's a lot that's wrapped up in this. And so it's interesting, and you know, we'll see how things develop. But it's great that we're paying closer attention or have more. There seems to be a little bit more incentive to make changes in our diet and our food. And so we're seeing that slowly.
Yeah. So, again, I think this is important for the medical profession to discuss, have ongoing dialogue, ongoing discussion. And I think that patient-doctor relationship is key. We as healthcare professionals must help the patient find the incentives for them to change their lifestyle. And so it's not only diet. Diet's important. And as I always say, shop around the periphery of the grocery store, not the aisles.
Yeah.
But also, coming back full circle to our first article on relationships, you know, if you can have some solid relationships, hold each other accountable, that is very helpful in your diet. Mm-hmm. And then give them some instructions on good exercise and good lifestyle. You know, turn off your TV, have certain set times, turn off your cell phones, go for a walk. I think the medical profession should be at the forefront of this.
Oh, absolutely. And that's my greatest concern with this is that people see it as this article on Ozempic Town USA suggests that people see it as a silver bullet. There's some sort of magic to this, and all I have to do is take this and my life is going to change. And that's where I get at the virtue. Well, how do you want your life to change? And what does it mean for your life to change? But certainly, there's a lot more that we can be doing. And just to think that's a mentality in our modern, given our modern sensibilities, we can just take a pill and everything's going to be great. We can take a pill and everything's going to change. And no, there's a lot more to it than that.
And a lot of these health issues, as I said, are interconnected. social isolation, which has become more prominent, diet, what's actually available for you to purchase at a cheap cost, the motivation. Anyway, there's a lot involved here. JC, this was fun. Let's do it again.
Indeed. Yes, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to CMDA's Voice of Advocacy podcast. If you would like to suggest a future guest or share a comment with us, please email us at advocacy@cmda.org. And if you like the podcast, be sure to give us a 5-star rating and share it on your favorite social media platform. This podcast has been a production of Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members, and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.